Hi everyone. Just wanted to let you all know a bit about this episode before we begin. Claire and I were very privileged to speak with Maria, who shares her incredible story, including her experience of losing her baby son, William. Some of you might choose to come back to this episode another time. And for those of you that need support or want more information around losing a baby, we recommend you get in touch with Tommies at www.tommies.org. You can find a link in our show notes. Here's the episode.
Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you. Because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi everyone, and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we are joined by Maria Viner, CEO of Mothers for Mothers, a Bristol-based charity which is celebrating its 40th year. Mothers for Mothers is run by those who have suffered and recovered from depression, anxiety or isolation during pregnancy or after the birth of their babies. Through therapies, helplines, support groups and home visits, their aim is to support women through what can be one of the most difficult and isolating periods of their lives. She's also a member of the Royal College of Obstetrician and Gynecologists Women's Networks and the Women's Voice Panel. And she's the Patient and Public Involvement Lead at the Tommies National Centre for Maternity Improvement. Welcome, Maria, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Nice to be with you both.
Oh, it's so lovely to have you, Maria. Lovely to meet you at last.
So Maria, I'd love to hear about your journey before you became a mum and before you were doing the work that you do now. What were you doing? What was your career like?
So my career was in law, and I had, like lots of other women, a difficult start with motherhood. So I had a number of early first trimester miscarriages and sort of had worries about, is this ever going to happen for me, like lots of women do who have that experience. But I was lucky and I did become pregnant with my first son, and I had an absolutely wonderful pregnancy and enjoyed every minute of it. And I do remember on times my husband said to me that I seemed more well pregnant than I did in normal life. And I worked through my pregnancy as well, and just didn't have any problems with that. Was completely happy, totally prepared, you know, to enter motherhood with all my expectations and dreams. And I planned a home birth, but when I got to 41 weeks, and there was still no sign of anything happening, I had an appointment with my midwives who wanted me to go to hospital for a well-being scan. And it was snowing and the hospital bus wasn't running, so I walked up the hill to the hospital in the snow at 41 weeks pregnant. And I didn't take a hospital bag with me because I wasn't going to stay and give birth at hospital. I was definitely coming home. I had everything prepared and that's what I wanted to do. When I had the scan, there'd been a loss of fluid around my baby, and the heartbeat was a little bit erratic. So they decided to induce me. And I was induced and 19 hours later gave birth in theatre with forceps to my son, my first son, who we called William. And we'd always known if we had a boy, he would be called William. He was delivered onto my chest and then he was taken away. And he did cry just once and then he was taken to NICU. So I didn't see him for a little while, and I went up to NICU, and he was alongside babies who were absolutely tiny, and he was a big, strong, healthy looking boy, and I just felt he it was something to do with the delivery and that he just needed some time and everything would be okay. But over the course of that day, it became obvious that things weren't okay at all. And 24 hours after he was born, he died in my arms. So that was sort of my introduction to motherhood. And I went through a period then of, you know, a grieving process and that feeling of being a mum, but not being seen as a mum because you don't have your baby with you, which was really quite hard and quite a difficult period in my life for me and for my husband.
I can imagine. Well, I can't imagine, actually. Every parent's worst nightmare, really, isn't it? I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. And
thank you.
I'm very grateful for you for sharing that story and for sharing your birth story of William as well, which often when people have experienced a loss, sometimes that doesn't get told, and sometimes women want to tell their birth story even though ultimately they didn't get to take their baby home with them. The worst that could possibly happen has happened. Where do you go from there?
I was lucky in that I lived somewhere where there was a local SANS group and I had support from SANS, and I met people who had experienced similar. And there was a great strength in meeting those people. And I also made a friendship online with someone whose baby had died in very similar circumstances at the same hospital, but she lived in Cornwall. And we were a great source of strength to each other. And for both of us, it was our first child. Her child was a little girl. And we've both gone on to have other children, and we're godparents to each other's children and still very close friends. And there's gifts that your child that dies gives you, and for me one of those gifts is the friendships that I've made through my experience of having him and losing him and meeting other people who've been through the same and supporting each other on those journeys, but in particular supporting each other through subsequent pregnancies, which can be for some people who've experienced the death of their baby really quite tough times in life.
I can only imagine, especially when you felt that your first pregnancy had been such a positive experience and you had, you know, no feeling or indication that anything was untoward, or so to have that happen in such a kind of shocking and quick way, I imagine it might be losing trust in yourself a bit and trusting your body and knowing what, you know, that anything can happen. It was probably quite hard to find moments of joy in your subsequent pregnancies. Was that the case? Or
completely. And you're completely right. You've hit the nail on the head there. I completely lost trust in my ability as a woman to be pregnant and to give birth to a healthy child. But the draw to being a parent was so strong, it gives you the strength to carry on and to do that. And for some people that isn't the case, or for some people they really struggle to conceive another baby. But for us, we did wait for a little while, and we waited until it felt like it was a time where emotionally we were both ready, so we didn't try again straight away. But I was very lucky and I became pregnant with my second son. And I was anxious all the way through that pregnancy. I didn't have a moment's peace in that pregnancy. And at no point did I believe that I would be bringing a baby home. And it was really the anxiety that was the big problem in that pregnancy. Because of the condition my first son died in, I was under consultant care, which obviously was a very different pregnancy experience. And it was very different to the person that I had been before, who was very much, I can do this, I want to have a home birth, I don't want medical interventions, I want to be left alone to birth as I'm designed to. So I just had to adapt to that. And I was lucky in that I had a fantastic consultant who was incredibly supportive and took the time and space to get to know me and know what was important to me. And I did see him very regularly. I was scanned every week. But we didn't know. There was no test to tell us whether this baby was okay. And that was sort of my main source of anxiety. And plus, I didn't have that magic date to get to. If I get to this date, everything will be okay. Like I kind of had that sense after my early miscarriages, if I could get beyond 13 weeks, things would be okay. And I didn't have that this time around. And I opted for an elective section at 38 weeks, which the previous me, that wouldn't have been something I would ever have considered, but that was the absolute best choice for me and my family. And it was a really lovely experience. So quite often women who have sections feel like their baby's delivered and that they don't have the opportunity to give birth. And I felt both. Because I felt held. I felt held by the maternity care providers who were looking after me, who delivered my baby. But I felt active in that process that I gave birth to him too. So my midwife, and I had continuity of care midwives, so I knew my midwife team and I knew them from my first pregnancy. And my midwife, who I'd seen all the way through this second and subsequent pregnancy, was there in theatre with me and held my hand and didn't have another job to do, because there was another midwife there who was doing the midwife job. She was just there for me. And I'd built up, obviously, a really great relationship with my consultant by that point, and he was there. And I felt, and I'd had the opportunity to go into the theatre before the section, because it was the same theatre where my son William was born, and to see it, and to, so it wasn't my first time back in the same room, which was incredibly helpful. And they made it as wonderful experience as they possibly could, given how anxious I was. And he was born and he cried immediately. And, you know, he was a little bit bigger than his brother and big, healthy, strong boy. So, you know, that went well. But afterwards, I was in hospital for a week with him. And that's when things started to go downhill. And I became withdrawn. I started to feel very, very isolated, and the anxiety that I'd experienced prior to giving birth turned very quickly into quite a deep depression, quite a deep depressive illness. My husband thought, you know, let's just get home and then we can settle down and start becoming a family and you'll be okay. But it didn't change and it carried on. And one of the really big things for me was although I had him at home and he was there with me and I was feeding him myself, I just didn't have that confidence that he was there to stay at any minute. And I didn't know what it was that could happen, whether it would be, you know, something happening and him becoming ill and him dying, or whether it would be somebody walking through the door and taking him away. But I just did not have that confidence that he was there to stay. And I couldn't voice that at all. And it wasn't until he was 6 weeks old that my husband said to me he'd been feeling that way. And I can remember even now that sense of relief rushing through me that I could actually voice that, say it out loud and talk about it. But I became very, very poorly following his birth.
So up until that point where you and your husband had that really meaningful sharing, was all this just in your head, like thinking all these big thoughts about what might happen to your baby, and there was nowhere really to go with that?
It was in my head, Claire, but actually I could feel it physically as well. And it's sort of that sense of impending doom 24 hours a day, that there's nothing you can do to distract yourself from, and sort of that sick feeling in the pit of your stomach all the time. Just so worried, so anxious, so on red alert, with adrenaline just rushing through me, that I just didn't have that opportunity to enjoy those early days that had kind of been robbed from me with my first son, and now I couldn't relax and enjoy them with my second.
So it sounds like you had such incredible support throughout the pregnancy and that birthing process. You know, they were really with you. I was like getting the tingles listening to you speak, Maria. What wonderful support. And then it seems like, did you not get so much support in that first 6 weeks postnatally? What happened to, you know, the continuity of care or the health visitors, or were they there and you just didn't feel like you could talk to them?
So I was lucky in that my midwives at the time, they could extend the time that they visit you, and they extended to 1 month. So rather than just your first 2 weeks of visits, I had 1 month with my midwives. And I guess my first week was in hospital. So it was 3 weeks at home with them visiting me, which I don't really have a memory of. I'm sure it was supportive, but I don't really remember seeing them. I think I was just so enveloped in this anxiety, I didn't really know what was going on outside of it. And I'd never met my health visitor before, and I met her when my son was about 4 weeks old, and I just felt there was no relationship or connection, and I just felt that there was this overwhelming attitude from professionals towards me of, well, you've got a baby now, so just get on with it. And I couldn't. I was doing absolutely everything I could to be the best mum that I could, but I wasn't doing anything to look after myself. So all his needs were met absolutely perfectly, but I couldn't look after myself because I had no extra fuel in the tank to do that. And also I didn't know what I needed. So that was really, really difficult. And as that went on, I just became more and more ill. But of course, I didn't know I was ill. I just thought I was a bad mum. And I thought everybody else around me was doing this perfectly and easily. But there was something wrong with me. For goodness sake, my first baby died. You know, it's me. It's my fault. I'm the one who's not doing this properly. I just need to sort myself out and get on with it and do it properly. And that possibly was reinforced by some of the healthcare professionals I met. Probably not all of them, but I don't remember any supportive or helpful conversations. I only remember the really unhelpful ones, because they're the things that stick with you when you're ill, because those are the ones that stay in your head and that you play round and round and round as intrusive thoughts that you ruminate on.
And also when you are experiencing those feelings that you were talking about, and that hypervigilance, that you're looking for the things that are going to go wrong, you're looking for the bad things, you're looking for the danger, you can't see the good stuff, you can't, you know, your filter is so attuned to the negative. Even if you had someone that was perhaps saying lots of lovely things, you probably really couldn't have even taken that in or absorbed it in that time. And, you know, that's one of the aspects of when you have postnatal illness or depression or anxiety is, you know, all the other people in their life, they're not seeing the world that you're seeing at that time.
Mm.
It sounds like, you know, this really deeply affected those early days with your son. When did the change come about? Can you remember when you realised that actually this was an illness and that this wasn't just you and it wasn't anything to do with how you were mothering? What happened next?
That was a very long process, actually, Claire. And it wasn't something that came easily. So I was just trying my absolute best, and I was trying to get out and about in the community and make friends with babies of the same age, but I found it really difficult. There were a couple of reasons for that. One is that my son would only feed in the underarm position, and that's a really difficult position to feed in when you're out and about. So I just didn't ever feel very confident about being out for really long periods of time with him. So I would feed him, you know, before I went out and hope that I wouldn't need to feed him again until we got back in, which made me anxious about feeding, which wasn't very helpful. The other thing was he had a really severe reflux. So every time he did feed, he vomited and then needed another feed, which, you know, was great fun. And I can remember my GP, I had really bad mastitis, and my GP saying to me, it was like I was feeding twins. And I thought, well, at least I've only got one baby crying, not two. So, you know, it could always be worse. It could always be harder. But the other reason I found it difficult being out and about, I have quite severe dyslexia, and part of my dyslexia is I have a hearing processing disorder, so I can't cope with lots of background noise. So if you imagine going to sorts of mum and baby groups, which are in big halls and it's very, very echoey and there's lots going on and lots of different noise, I couldn't ever concentrate on having a conversation with someone because of all that additional noise. And I was never really quite sure what they were saying. And I think due to how deep my depression had come. I think my cognition was a little bit affected at that point as well. So I found that really difficult, and it was almost like I'd given myself another stick to beat myself up with. I can't even go out and make friends. And so my baby can't make friends, so I can't do anything right. And I spiraled lower and lower and lower into this depressive state. But I was somewhere one day and I saw a poster, and it had lots and lots of words on it. But one of the words that I saw was lonely. And I sort of looked at that word and I thought, gosh, you know, that's what's happened. I'm lonely. I'm really, really lonely. And that I hooked onto that, and I thought, I don't think there's anything else wrong. I'm just really lonely. So I rang the number on the poster, and it was a poster for Mothers for Mothers. And I spoke to someone and I said, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just really lonely. And she said, would you like us to come and visit you? And would you like to come to one of our groups? And I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a go. It might be easier than going to the other groups, because there might be other women there that are lonely, and it might be easier to meet other women who feel lonely. And I did, and I sort of met a worker from Mothers for Mothers, and she was very, very kind. And she took me to the group, which was made it much easier to go. And there I met my people. They were all there.
You found your tribe.
Yeah, yeah. They were there. My guys were all there. And I still didn't think I was ill, but I'd met somewhere where, which didn't feel hostile, it didn't feel difficult to be, and it felt, it was a place that could keep me safe. And also, I felt that my son, it was a good place for my son, because he was doing all the things he should be doing that I wasn't managing to make happen for him. So it was perfect. It really was absolutely perfect. And, you know, I went along for quite a number of weeks and sat and listened to other people and talked to other people and felt supported and held and felt a little bit lighter. And one of the people who worked for Mothers for Mothers said to me, you know, would you like some counselling? We can, you know, arrange some counselling for you if you'd like. And of course, I'd had counselling after William had died, and I thought, well, I'm not really sure if it would be helpful, but I'll give it a try and see what happens. So I started having counselling for Mothers for Mothers, and it was during that counselling I started to process what had happened. And I made the connection. I realised, gosh, I'm actually poorly. And I'm actually really quite poorly. And at that point, I was suffering from maternal OCD, which was something I'd never heard of before. And I was suffering from quite a lot of post-traumatic stress, as well as, you know, quite intense anxiety and a very deep depressive illness. So I had quite a lot going on. It's no wonder that it's difficult to see your way through that, to realise you're actually ill. And I think quite a lot of people, women, find themselves in that position. So that was really helpful. And that was sort of, that was the beginning. It was the beginning of me understanding the person I'd become and understanding my illness. But it wasn't the first steps to recovery. They came after my third child, because I had another pregnancy to go through and to get through. So the counselling got me well enough to feel that I could become pregnant again.
Wow, that sounds like a very powerful healing that happened within that counselling.
Yes, yeah. And I'll always be very grateful for it, because I think had it been suggested anywhere else, it wouldn't have felt as something that I could access, and it wouldn't have felt that something that was going to be supportive or centred around me. But because it had come from those weeks of building up my trust in those women, making those friendships, feeling supported and heard and held, that it was something that I could then access.
Yeah, and you also used the word safe.
Very safe, yeah. And I think that was the first time I'd felt safe since I went into theatre for him to be born.
So you were holding so much for so long, and then feeling that safeness and having that support and that special counsellor, there was some room then for you to start looking at some of this stuff that had been going on. So powerful, Maria, because I think so many mums feel like feeling lonely or feeling isolated, so many feel like that's normal. So what would you maybe say to some of those women coming up behind you? What would be some of the kind of red flags you might suggest that if they're feeling this particular way, where should they go for some help and what should they maybe be thinking of to help them with their journey?
It's very difficult because obviously everyone's very different, and some people are very much more aware of these sorts of feelings because it may well be that they've experienced some emotional well-being issues or some anxiety or depression prior to becoming mums, and they're sort of more in tune with their own mental well-being and their mental health. And for me, I hadn't, and it was all new to me. So for some people, they will be aware, and they will know in their pregnancy when they're more than kind of like worried well, because all women feel a little bit worried in pregnancy about various things and a new symptom or something which doesn't feel quite right. And quite often it's something which is not that significant, and you can talk to your maternity care provider and get some reassurance and feel okay. Sometimes it's something which does need a little bit more investigating. And I think when you're under quite scrutinized care, actually that can make you feel safe and make you feel that you're being listened to and heard, and that, you know, the best possible care is available for you and your baby. But also it's intense, and that intensity can also cause a little bit of anxiety as well. I can remember I used to say that I would have a scan and everything would be looking good on that scan that day, and I would have a great feeling of relief for the rest of the day and feel good for the rest of the day. And then sort of towards that evening or the next day, the anxiety would start to creep back again, because you only know that everything's okay at that moment during that scan, and anything could change in between that scan and the next few hours. So I think if you're, you know, from my experience of my first pregnancy, you know, not being poorly at all and being really well, and I didn't really have any anxiety or worries. But I think, you know, lots of women do, but it's difficult to know when that's just what everyone experiences or when that's becoming a little bit more serious. And I think when it's becoming a little bit more serious, it's when it interrupts your day-to-day life. So you can't do the normal things you would do. You can't have the normal, like, fun with friends or enjoyment of, I don't know, reading a book or watching a TV show without some of those thoughts and anxieties intruding into your activity, what you're doing. So I think for anyone who feels that way, and whether that's while you're pregnant or after you've had your baby, if those worries are so much so that you're just not getting those moments of enjoyment that you would normally get, then that's something to be thinking about, having a conversation with someone. And it, you know, whoever that might be, it may be your GP, it could be the health visitor, it could be a friend or family member, or it could be reaching out to a support organisation. I think just starting to have those conversations are what can help you start to process what's happening and how you're feeling and what's going on, and thinking about ways that you can keep yourself as well as you possibly can. And again, those are all different for everybody.
I think one of the things you mentioned, you realised that you had PTSD, you realised in hindsight that you had OCD, and yet you didn't realise you were ill at the time. And some people might be really surprised by that, you know, how can you be experiencing such strong feelings and not realise that there's something wrong? But actually, I think that's a very common thing. I wrote a little social media post a while ago about all the reasons I thought I wasn't depressed after I'd had my son, and I listed all the things, the reasons I told myself there was nothing wrong with me, when in fact there, you know, I was suffering, and my joy was, I wasn't able to feel joy, and you know, even when things were going well, I was worried about when they wouldn't be going well, rather than just enjoying that moment of them going well. And I, as part of my recovery, I was sent into a group with other women we'd all been diagnosed with postnatal depression. And I was in a room with about 12 other people. It's called Out of the Blue. And every single woman that was there presented completely differently. We all were suffering in totally different ways. In fact, I really thought at the time, this blanket term is not helpful, because I don't look or feel anything like how these other women, and
they don't look or feel anything like how the others are feeling. The only thing we've got in common is that we've just had a baby. And I had I knew people that had had postnatal depression, and that was one of the reasons why it wasn't me, because I wasn't doing things the way they were doing things. I wasn't crying in my room and not getting out of my pajamas for days at a time, which is what I thought it looked like. I was out, I was doing the things, I was, I worked really hard to make sure that I looked like everything was going well on the outside. But it was my internal experience that was, I wasn't being honest about what was really going on the inside.
I don't think that's uncommon, Claire. And I think there's a lot of that, just not with motherhood, but with being women generally, whereby it doesn't matter what's happening. We have to get up, dress up, get out and get on with it. In work situations and all sorts of situations, some people feel that pressure, or it's part of their personality, that you just put your best face on and do things to the absolute best of your ability. And you don't ask for help, because sometimes you don't actually realise you need help or that help's available, or actually you're too embarrassed to admit that, and you would feel too ashamed if people knew that you weren't coping. And I think, that happens to women anyway, and certainly happens to women professionally. But I think it, for some of us, that does carry over into motherhood as well. And I was really, really severely ill, and I didn't know that, but that was part of the illness, because it had completely clouded my judgment and my ability to look at myself and see clearly what was happening. And unfortunately for me, it all became much worse during my third pregnancy as well, although I felt that I was ready. I was ready because it was kind of, it felt like now or never. I've got to do it now, or I'm just never going to be brave enough to do it again.
So what was your third pregnancy like?
Well, we tried to conceive for a year and it didn't happen for us. So, and anyone who's ever had any fertility issues will sort of understand how difficult that can be when you're sort of like having that 2 week wait after your fertile time, not knowing whether you're pregnant or not, but hoping and almost acting like you're pregnant because you really want that to be true, and watching what you're eating and drinking and all those sorts of things that you do when you're pregnant, but doing it before you've even had the positive test, and then either having the start of your period or having a negative test, and how it's almost just like a soccer punch every month having that, and then picking yourself up and thinking you've got to try again, and the strain that puts on your relationship as well when everything about your relationship is all about having another baby. So that was hard, and we had a year of that. And I went to my GP, and because of my age at the time, I had some testing straight away, and I met the threshold to actually be referred to the fertility clinic because things weren't looking good for us at all. So we went along to the fertility clinic and started having testing there, and we were just about to start having more invasive procedures done when I decided to do something sort of a little bit off the cuff, a little bit odd maybe, but something which was from my pre-having babies personality. I went to Glastonbury and I walked the labyrinth in St. John's Churchyard barefoot, and I walked into the centre of the labyrinth asking for a baby, and walked out of the centre of the labyrinth imagining that baby girl in my arms. I then climbed up the tour and sat on the egg stone, which is a fertility stone. And I went to the chalice well. And one of my baby's godparents is part of the chalice well. And she did a water blessing for us, and it was a fertility water blessing for us, and scattered the water all over us. And I stood in the channel of water, of running water in the well. And this was on the 18th of December, which was my birthday. And it's freezing in, the midst of summer. And it was absolutely freezing in December, standing in that water. And my husband and my initials are J&M. And my dear friend from Cornwall, who I met after my first baby died, her and her husband's initials are J&M. And they hadn't had another baby by this point. And the water was in a beautiful bottle and it had J&M fertility written on it. And I poured it back into the water for it to go out to anybody else who was trying for a baby. And I conceived my daughter that night. And my friend, 11 days later, conceived her son.
Oh, that is just wonderful. A lot of the time, it's quite easy to talk about medical procedures and what happens physiologically, but we really believe that that's not the full human experience. And what you've just described there, and it, you know, that shift from looking at, you know, when am I ovulating, what am I doing, getting the tests, all that other, you know, the kind of almost logical scientific way we aim to get pregnant sometimes, and it was actually kind of opening yourself up to things that were beyond your control that allowed it to happen. Amazing story. I love that.
It was a little bit of me capturing my former self again, because it was a nod back to the previous me before all these really difficult things happened to me in my life, and a little bit more of me, of the way that I used to live my life. And, you know, I just had to take that leap of faith and believe this was going to work. And I was going to be pregnant with a daughter and everything was going to be okay. And then obviously in the new year, I found out I was pregnant.
How did you feel in that moment?
Just really excited, really, really excited and really hopeful. And I hadn't been able to feel hopeful in my other pregnancy, but I did feel hopeful. And I thought, you know, it doesn't matter what happens this time. I'm prepared now. I know how bad things can be, but I know how to find support, and I know that I'm not well, and I can be honest about that. And so it doesn't matter if they're difficult, it will be okay this time. And I didn't believe it could be as difficult as it had been, but unfortunately I was wrong.
So it sounds like you've been on such a huge journey, Maria. What happened next?
I became very ill very quickly during the pregnancy, and all the old anxieties returned, but obviously I was really depressed, and my OCD was really difficult to live with. I did seek help. I sought clinical help this time. I didn't feel heard or understood. I didn't feel dismissed, but I felt pigeonholed into something which wasn't me, and I didn't feel any trust, so I couldn't take the advice. It was very much with my care for my mental health. It didn't feel like I was well informed at all, and it didn't feel like any of the decision making was shared or informed. And so my option that I felt to keep myself safe and keep my baby safe was to disengage from it completely. And I thought, I will just take my chances with my consultant again. And then he changed hospitals when I was 20 weeks. So I went with him and I changed hospitals. And that was good, but it was a different experience. And it meant I couldn't have my midwives with me at the birth. And so the birth was really where things got very difficult for me. When I was pregnant, my dad died, and the baby was due to be born around about my dad's birthday, and I really didn't want that to happen. I had an elective section, it was booked for the 2nd of September, and that was because I wanted to miss my dad's birthday. I wanted my baby to have a different day. And I couldn't really grieve for my dad during the pregnancy because there was too much else going on. And what had happened to me was, you know, obviously my first son had died. While I was pregnant with my second son, my father-in-law had died. And my father-in-law was buried next to my first son. So we had a very formal visit to his grave with the rest of the family again. And then when I was pregnant with my daughter, my own dad died. And I'd had these intrusive thoughts going around my head all the time about, when I'm pregnant, someone dies, who who is it going to be this time? But when it came to giving birth to her, you know, I had an elective section again, this time at 39 weeks, which that extra week made such a big difference to my anxiety levels. They were literally through the roof at that point. And it was much, I remember it being the preparation for her being born was sort of less centered around me than it had been with my second son. And it was much more of a procedure. And I didn't have a midwife in the theatre for me. There obviously was a midwife in there, but I don't know who she was, and she didn't introduce herself to me. And, you know, there'd always been trouble with me and spinals in the past, and they'd had seen my notes and seen what had happened at the other hospital setting. I was in a horrific amount of pain. I was just on gas and air. And she was born, and she was delivered right onto my chest and left with me on my chest. And she was absolutely beautiful. And she was everything that I'd hoped and dreamed for. She was obviously a little bit poorly, and she was taken to NICU. And she had two little holes in her heart, and they were nothing serious at all. But in my mind, he was another baby that was going to die, because my experience of NICU was not a place where babies go to get a little bit of support and get better and go home. My experience with NICU was that's where babies go to die. So I couldn't look at her. I didn't want to bond with her, because if I did, I would love her. And if I loved her, she would die. But it was really important to me that I did feed her, because I wanted to give her the best possible chance to be well and healthy. So it was hard for her and hard for me. Going home was hard. And I found it very, very hard to care for her. But babies are very clever. And my son had been really looking forward to her being born. And they made a really strong bond immediately. And all the eye contact that babies look for, she had it with him. And they were so close and so happy right from the get-go. And that kept me going. But my OCD was out of control by this point. For me, it took the form of packing and unpacking bags. And part of that was about trying to be in control of situations, because the worst thing that had happened to me in my life when my son died was when everything spiralled out of my control. From the moment that midwife said to me in the community setting, I just want you to pop to hospital and have a scan to make sure everything's right. And for me, trying to get control back meant being completely prepared for any eventuality. And that's why the contents of my bag was so important, because it didn't matter what sort of day it was or where we were going or anything, that bag had to be perfect. And as soon as it was packed, I would then doubt myself and I'd have to take everything out and start again from the beginning. And it wasn't until I actually put everybody's life in danger with these compulsive thoughts that I knew I was seriously ill again. And what happened was I stopped on the motorway, and I stopped on the first lane. I didn't pull into the hard shoulder, and I got out of the car to pack and unpack the bag, because that compulsion to do so was so strong. I couldn't see or hear or understand anything else that was going on around me, and I thought that was the only thing I could do to keep my baby safe. And I had no comprehension of the danger that I was putting other road users, my children, myself in at all. And it was in the aftermath of that I was like, okay, this is just not good. This has gone too far. I now need to be honest about this and tell people about this, and I need help for it. And I had CBT, and it was helpful, but it wasn't the right time. And I had just had to give it time. So my journey with her continued for the first year of her life. I don't really have much memories around that. And just after her first birthday, we went away, and I had had a conversation with my husband before we went that I would carry on feeding her while we were away, because we were flying and it just felt easier than, you know, she was at an age where she could have, you know, started taking cow's milk. You know, it wasn't that we would have to take lots of bottles and formula and sterilise and everything, but I just thought, let's just do it for the holiday and then I'll think about giving up feeding when we get back. But whilst we were away, she decided on her own accord she didn't want to feed anymore. She'd had enough of it and just refused. And I remember my last feed with her, and it wasn't one of those lovely, perfect, it wasn't this lovely and cosy and wonderful and bonding type feeds. It was her just absolutely not wanting to do it and wanting a bowl of Cocoa Pops instead or something like that. And a couple of days later, I was on the beach and she wasn't quite walking, and her and my son were playing in the sea just where the waves break. And they had one of those little bodyboard things which they were playing with, and they were absolutely squealing with delight, the way that young children just, when they laugh, and it just is a sound which takes over everything. And I just had that thought at that moment. I've never heard them both laugh before, but they must have been doing that because I know they have fun. But I'm hearing it for the first time, and it set something off in me, which was a reignition of that rush of love that I had for her that moment when she was born, that I'd suppressed all that time because I thought something was going to happen to her. And so it was like I rebonded with her, really. And from that moment on, I just thought, do you know, look at them. They're just both absolutely wonderful. I'm so lucky to have them. I need to get better and I need to enjoy being their mum. I came back from that holiday and I talked to my peer support worker at Mothers for Mothers, and I told her what had happened. And I said, I just really, really want to get better. And she said, well, let's do it. Come on, let's make a plan. Let's get you better. And she supported me all the way through that. And I was back at work by my daughter's second birthday. So it did still take quite a long time. And I then had CBT when I was ready for it. And then it was really helpful. And it got me to a place where, right, I can be back at work. And I'd thought at that point, I would never be well enough to work, you know, before that point, rather, I'd never be well enough to work again. I thought that was my career over, work, until I was well enough to. And when I was well enough to, I just wanted to get back to work because I could be a good mum and I could go to work. And the CBT did really help with that.
You know, after all that time and all that journey before you were pregnant the first time, this is how you imagined your life would be, that you would be at work and that you would be a great mum. And so to finally get there after, or to know that it was within grasp after all that time when you thought that that dream had completely gone, I'm so happy for you that that was possible. And I love how you took agency in that, I've decided I'm going to get better. And then when in that moment, you then had the right person there to say, I'm with you, we're going to do this. I feel like we women are unstoppable and we are so strong, and there's nothing like having another woman beside you, behind you. There's no doubt in my mind, as soon as you made that decision with that person there saying, yes, we're going to do this, it was going to happen. And obviously it is a long journey and it's not easy, and that's only the kind of the first step, I suppose, in a way. But what a moment of power, what a moment of taking back what you deserved in your life. Your journey and your story, Maria, is, I know everyone's going to be absolutely feeling this with you. And thank you so much for being so honest and sharing it so beautifully. I really hope that a lot of people will look to your strength and your bravery for doing this and maybe find someone, you know, I'd say to anyone out there, whoever you can feel safe with sharing your true feelings. A lot of the times we don't, because we're worried. People will think we're a bad mum or we're a bad person. And just having those intrusive thoughts, things can only really get better when we're able to find that support. I think it's unusual for people to come through these difficulties without support. I'm sure it is possible, but we may be experts on ourselves, but luckily out there are people that really are experts on these kind of conditions and these kinds of experiences. And to seek that help and to seek the benefit of their experience and their knowledge and their learnings can only support you in moving through this journey, hopefully a little bit quicker, might be if you're left just by yourself to get on with it.
It's very powerful to know that you're not alone. Absolutely. Very comforting rather than powerful, I think. Very comforting to know you're not alone. It's actually very powerful to know you're not alone and that there's a woman who has experienced it and recovered. and it gives you hope that you can do the same. And that is one of the strengths of peer support and why peer support is so important, because you can have wonderful clinical care, but sometimes you need to see you to be you. And if you can see some of yourself and some of what you're going through and some of your illness in somebody else, and you know that they've managed to overcome that and that they can help support you to overcome it, it really does give you hope that your recovery is possible.
Hearing your experience, I am so glad that you have your other role as advisor on the panel for RCOG. I can see how some of the worst and best bits of your experience can help inform professionals looking after women on providing better care, on providing more women-centered care. And you know, you spoke about continuity of care and building that relationship and feeling agency in the decisions around you and what a huge difference that made. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work with that and what changes you've seen, what changes have you helped to bring about?
I'm very privileged to be part of the Women's Network at the RCOG, and it's been, I hope and I believe that I have brought a lot to that role, and that it's, I have had the opportunity to share experiences of the women that we work with at Mothers for Mothers here in Bristol through that role, and to share their views. But it's also been a great education for me as well, because I'm with 12 other women who are all experts in their field. And, you know, I don't know a great deal about gynecology, but I certainly learn a huge amount from them, and I think that they have the opportunity to learn from me about some of the things that I've experienced and some of the work that I do here in Bristol. So it's a great forum for women. Part of what we do is we inform all the work of the college. So everything which happens from the college, from guidelines, from patient information, from conferences, all the way to the exams that the specialist trainees sit once they specialise in obstetrics and gynaecology, their written exams all the way through to the exams that they take right at the end of their student life when they're in their fifth year. We are part of everything to do with that. And I sit on one of the exam committees myself, and I'm also an examiner. So lay people like myself examine medical students at, well, they're not medical students, they're doctors at that point, but we examine doctors at that point in their career. We also write the exam questions for them. So they're very centred around the things that are important to women. So we really are at the centre of that college, and our voices are heard loud and clear. And I think that one of the biggest changes that I've seen since I first started in that role is the change in language, and how that language, and we're not there yet. It's a long process to change language, to change clinical language, but it's much better than it was, and it's much more women-centered, and it's improving all the time. And it's part of what we're doing in the Tommy's Maternity Improvement Centre, is we are absolutely ensuring that the language that we use as a centre to maternity care providers is the same language that they will use with women. So, you know, I don't know whether you want me to give some small examples, but of things which just make situations better is things like when we, in that centre, something that we're looking at is preeclampsia, which comes about by problems with the placenta, and we refer to the function of the placenta rather than placental dysfunction, because it's just a better way to explain it. We talk about chances rather than always talking about risks, and we quantify those chances so people have a better understanding and they're not scared of having those conversations because they're not all surrounding risk. We talk about changes in fetal movements rather than reduced fetal movements, because sometimes those changes aren't something to worry about, but it's always advisable that women talk to their maternity care provider when they do feel a change in their baby's movements. So just little tweaks and changes to language can really have a positive effect on someone's maternity experience. And that's very important. So that, and that follows through, you know, as the years go by and the guidelines are reviewed, we'll see that changing through the guidelines. We've already seen huge changes to the patient information leaflets, and we definitely see the changes in the exams. And when you see, when people are exams inform learning, and when you need to understand and speak in a certain way for an exam, you will naturally be carrying that through to your practice. And so we will see the change in how our consultants of the future care for women because of the Women's Network and the fact that they're the centre of the college. So it's a huge privilege to be involved in that and be part of that work. And I feel very, you know, it's been great opportunities for me through doing that. I had the opportunity to speak to the Duchess of Cambridge about the work we do in Hartcliffe, which was, you know, a wonderful experience. And feel that it's an opportunity to make a difference. And there's so much more to do. That this work will never be finished. It will never be completed. And I'm just like someone who's journeying on it. There's so many women who came before me who made it possible for me to do the bit that I do. And there will be amazing, brilliant women far better than me after me coming along and building on the work that we've done. And it's so important because there really shouldn't be difficulties in relationships between women and their maternity care providers. It's a time in your life where that relationship should be a source of strength. So everything we can do to make that happen is really, really important. And obviously the work on gynaecology that all of my colleagues do as well is equally important. It's just my focus is tend to be more on pregnancy, birthing people and you know, the postnatal period because of my day job and my own experience, I guess, too.
It sounds like great strides are happening, and how amazing to be at the centre of that. And, you know, language is something we talk about quite a lot. I'm sure with some of the women that you've worked with and some of the people I've worked with, often it's afterwards when you hear them kind of reviewing their birth experiences and going through their story, it's that narrative that they're carrying with them much more powerfully almost than kind of the moment in the experience itself. It's the story and the revisiting it and the going over and over it. And what I hear a lot, which sort of I feel it in my tummy, it makes me feel a bit uncomfortable, is when I hear the phrases, they let me do this, they said I was allowed to do that, and it just takes away women's or people's choices. And I was just going to ask, out of curiosity, because obviously you're doing a lot in language, have those couple of phrases been earmarked, and maybe could they be reframed into questions to give women and people going through these experiences choices around what options might be available to them, rather than the narrowing it down and going, we're just going to let you do this, or you're allowed to do that? It seems quite disempowering. And I just wondered if there was anything changing with those two particular phrases, because those are the ones I hear all the time.
I think it takes a long time for changes to trickle through, and with long-standing organisations it takes a long time. We did some really big pieces of work around about 2018, 2019 on a new curriculum for obstetrics and for gynaecology. Part of that is the phrase which you may have heard now, which is around informed decision making. And prior to that, decision making was shared, which gave the impression that the maternity care provider, the clinician, whoever it was, had an equal say in that decision to the woman. And we've moved away from that, that if the woman is given, and her family, if that's appropriate, are given all the information that they need in a way that is very clear to them that they can understand, then they can make the informed choice about what's best for them and their family. And nobody else can do that. You can't share that with a clinician or anybody else. The power to do that has to lie with the woman. But with choice, there are some people in certain situations and they want to share that decision, and when that's appropriate they should be allowed to. And sometimes that can just be because things are so medically complex and perhaps they have such a good relationship of trust with whoever it is that's caring for them, they feel comfortable to share that decision and they should be allowed to do that. We shouldn't be telling people that's not appropriate, you have to make an informed decision yourself. Sometimes you need to be held by your maternity care provider, and it's really important to allow that for women.
That's a really, really powerful distinction there, Maria. Thank you.
I think what you describe, what I've heard and I've experienced as well with women with babies in NICU, about feeling that you have to ask permission to do every piece of personal care you want to do for that baby, and almost like that baby belongs to the hospital, not to you. And I think there's probably some work to do around that so women don't feel that way. I'm in no way being critical of staff who work in NICUs, because oh my goodness, what a hard job, and they hear the beeps of those monitors in their sleep every time they are asleep, I'm sure. But I think it's around antenatal education. I think if we're going to have an honest conversation about this, it's around antenatal education, because so much of this stuff you don't know anything about until you become pregnant, and you may not even hear about it when you're pregnant, and you may not have conversations about the possibility of your baby being in special care or in NICU until a point where you know something is likely to go wrong. So you don't have the opportunity to ask the questions about what am I allowed to do and what is acceptable to do. And you're there not knowing whether you do need to ask permission or whether you can just do instinctively what you feel you want to do as a mum. And I think what holds people back is they're worried about harming their baby because their baby seems so vulnerable in those positions. So I think it's, you know, antenatal education could do lots to inform women about, you know, their pregnancy and their body and that being theirs, and their choices around their birth and their care of their baby. And I just think we don't have those open and honest conversations with women during pregnancy, probably because I think we've always felt scared of someone, you know, someone having a first pregnancy who might be having a marvellous experience like I was. You don't want to burst their bubble, and you don't want to say, well, this could go wrong and that could go wrong and you could experience this and you could experience that. But actually, all the women who do have poor outcomes, and whether that's a poor outcome along the lines of the outcome I experienced or whether it's a poor outcome along the lines of something physically happening, a physical injury happening to the woman, undoubtedly, everyone says, I wish I'd known about this before and I had no idea something like this could happen. So I think that's where we really need to be concentrating our efforts, is in more informed antenatal education.
Completely agree. And I think that's a huge part of our motivation with our offering at Lush Tums. But I also feel that it's also a little bit too late. You know, the people that I'm working with, sometimes, you know, they come along to the pregnancy yoga classes or our antenatal education courses, and some of these things we're talking about, you know, their bodies, the hormones, the changes, what might happen in labor, you know, the choices they have around where they can have their baby, how they might want to be supported in those moments. It's almost like the first time they've ever had those conversations. You know, GCSE biology just does a few diagrams and doesn't really talk about consent and relationships and poor outcomes and all these other things. But actually, I really think we need to start that conversation in PSHE, in senior school, and take it right through. So when they come to the antenatal education, this isn't brand new information for them. We're topping up the gaps and giving them more support, not just telling them a whole load of stuff for the first time.
I agree with you, and it's almost as if you don't have that information before you become pregnant or before you start trying for a baby. And what you're saying is we need our young people to know this from an age before that's something that they're planning, because then when they are making the decision to have children, they're more informed about what that means and what that journey is about. It's interesting. And I think there's an awful lot of things that we could be improving our secondary school education with in terms of, you know, a better understanding of mental health and how to seek support for that, as well as, you know, a better understanding of parenthood and the realities of it. I think everything at the end does come down to education, doesn't it? But also to having open and honest conversations and learning from other people's experiences can be something which is really helpful.
That community element of what you've been speaking about, you know, in regards to, you know, your own experience as well, having that space to kind of reflect back some of your words of being seen and heard with where you're at in the moment is such a powerful thing that I feel like, and we talk about this in all of our podcasts, I'm sure it comes up, that in our busy lives, all living in our little houses, we're all quite separated from each other, and we might not have a strong community or a strong feeling of a place where we can be really honest with how we're feeling moment by moment. So I think those spaces, we need more of them, really, don't we? We need more sort of sharing circles and an ability to, you know, welcome the kids to class and be like, and how are you feeling? And like start it earlier, rather than us all trying to scrabble around after and realise we just need someone to hear us and hold us for a moment.
I don't disagree with you, but I think we need to be really mindful that everyone is very different, mm-hmm. and everyone needs that in a different way. Mm. And for some people, sharing en masse is really quite terrifying. And for some people, even talking to themselves about their emotions is very, very hard. So we just need to sort of have that acceptance that everybody's different. And we can't have something which is one size fits all, which is going to work for everybody. We need to concentrate on looking at people as individuals and being really person-centred about any support, any care and education and information that we're giving to people. People learn in very different ways as well. I'm very aware of that because of my own situation with my dyslexia and my daughter is severely dyslexic as well, but you know there's lots of people who aren't neurotypical, who learn in very different ways, and they need you know, they may need different ways of being cared for by services, but also they have different ways whereby they feel comfortable to share what's going on with them, what's in their life, what are their feelings, how mm-hmm. they are. And we always have that thing about asking people if they're okay, and people say they're fine and they're not really fine, and we know that, but we should still ask. Mm. And it's very, very important to have that boundary between pushing someone to talk and respecting that is something which isn't helpful for that person, and instead offering a way of, you know, what's happened and how do you feel about it? What can I do to help? Can I help you find something that will help for you? Just reframing things for people so we're not putting pressure on them to conform to our view of how they need to seek support.
Hmm. Is there anything you'd like to share? You know, we've focused on some of the really difficult parts of your journey, and we've touched on a few moments of real joy, and I really loved hearing the whole spectrum of experience. For someone who is having a really difficult time, who's maybe they're on their recovery journey or they're going through some healing now, but perhaps they don't feel like they're not quite there yet, are there any words of encouragement you might like to give to someone?
They will get there. They will. And I think something which isn't really spoken about is you recover and you become well again. But it doesn't mean that you can't take a step backwards and you can't see or hear or experience something which makes you feel a bit lousy again. That happens, but that's part of life. But you will get well in the way that the majority of your day you're able to function completely normally, and you're able to take joy from your life. You're able to do things you enjoy, and you're able to be happy with the people around you. It will happen. You will get there. And when you take a step backwards because something else comes along and gives you a bit of a shock, which quite often happens, I had one myself earlier this month, you will bounce back from that as well. It will happen for you. And it's, I guess it's a little bit like, you know, being stuck at the bottom of a hole and climbing a ladder to try and get yourself out. And you might slip down a few rungs, but you never go all the way back to the bottom. And if you've got people cheering you on from above and encouraging you up that ladder, and someone next to you who's going up the ladder at slight different pace, those are your people, and they're there to support you, and it's finding them. And that's really hard when you're ill. It's really hard to go out and find those people, but if you can find them, it makes that journey quicker, because it gives you the strength to go on for longer. I think motherhood is hard, and it's hard for some people from pregnancy, from trying to get pregnant, from pregnancy, birth, the early years, when your children are at school, when your children are teenagers, when you've got adult children. It's something that's really, really hard, but it's finding the opportunities to be in the moment during those moments of joy, and to really embrace them, and to almost box them away and keep them for when you need them, because they are the things which refuel you when you're low, when your energy's low, is just remembering those really absolutely fantastic joyful moments that you've witnessed.
I'm really feeling that, Maria, thank you. I was going to ask a quick question. If you wanted to just share a little bit for people that haven't come across Mothers for Mothers, just a little overview about the organisation and how people can reach out, and what you see can be really helpful from what you're offering.
Yeah, so I guess what I would say about Mothers for Mothers is it's like my fourth baby in a way. It's something which gives me so much joy. I have got the most incredible team. They are fantastic women. They're all women who've experienced and recovered from a mental health problem. They've all struggled with their emotional well-being, and they've recovered, and they care enough that they want to come back, and they want to make that journey a little bit easier for other women. The strength that they have shown over the last 18 months is incredible. They've all been dealing with their own anxieties around the pandemic, around restrictions, isolation. They've all been homeschooling young children, but they have got up and got ready and shown up and been there for other women every single day, and have provided incredible help and support to people in the most difficult of circumstances. I'm so proud of them. And that's sort of been highlighted this month when we were awarded the Queen's Award. And it's such a wonderful award because it recognises everybody and recognises everyone involved in the organisation, the hard work and the compassion and the care that they put into their roles and the work they do, every single one of them. So I'm incredibly proud of them. I did say at the time I felt both proud and humbled, and I know it's impossible to feel both those emotions at the same time, but I actually did. I somehow managed to feel proud and very, very humbled at the same time. But, you know, Mothers for Mothers saved my life. I was in the depth of suicidal ideation. I'd also made suicidal plans, and it was Mothers for Mothers that saved me. It wasn't any other service that stepped in and saved me and made sure that I was okay and that my children still have a mum now. It was Mothers for Mothers. And for that reason, they will always be really dear to my heart. And for that reason, when I had recovered and I'd sort of been back at work for around about 6 months, it felt completely the right thing to do to go back and volunteer my time. I didn't sort of envisage I'd still be here all these years later, still being involved. But, you know, life takes us on funny journeys sometimes, and here I am. But what is unique about Mothers for Mothers is that fact that everyone has that lived experience, and it is peer support in the very true nature. Even our art psychotherapist is a woman who has had a lived experience and recovered. What we do is, you know, we try and support women along that recovery journey. So we're not mental health experts, we are peer support workers. And we can listen, and we are there without judgment for women when they need us. The services that we provide, we have a helpline which is open Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. and people can ring that helpline whenever they need to talk. We also have a support call service which runs alongside the helpline, whereby we call women at a specific time, day of the week, and they speak to the same person, because I know how important that continuity is. So you're not retelling your story all the time. And people use those support calls as times to reflect on the week they've had and look at what's gone well and what hasn't been so well, and to plan for the week ahead. And it's just a touch point to really check in on where they are and how they're feeling in their journey. We also have a home visiting service which works with the women that are really struggling to get out and about in their community. And we do very specific pieces of work with them around what their needs are, which, you know, we assess at the beginning of our relationship with them, and we can do whatever it is they need us to do. So sometimes that's accompanying them to other medical appointments. It could be accessing things from Baby Bank for them. It could be finding a holiday for them with the Family Holiday Association. It could be, you know, getting them advice on housing problems or debt problems or domestic abuse, anything, whatever it is they're going through. We can support their emotional well-being whilst we help them access the other services they need. But a big part of that is getting them involved in something in their local community. And for some women, that could be coming along to our groups, our peer support groups, or it could be, you know, something else that's near to them that they want to get involved with, that they want to do. So it could be, for example, accessing a yoga class, or any other thing which is in their community that will be something which will help them start to feel a little bit more joy in their life and give them the confidence to get out and about and to start forming connections and friendships within their community, which will help them as they journey to recovery. And I mentioned there our peer support groups. So we have peer support groups which, you know, to an outsider looking in at one of those groups, it looks like a standard mother and baby group. But actually, everyone involved there is, you know, all the mums who come along have got a problem with their mental health, and all the people working there or volunteering there are recovered women of lived experience. And so it's a very safe place to be. And that was my experience of it being a safe place to be listened to be heard, to listen to others, and to feel safe and to feel held and to feel like you're making steps towards your recovery. And alongside those at the moment, because of the COVID restrictions that are still in place, we do have some walking groups, which are like walk and talk sessions, which are hugely popular. And so we will, you know, whatever happens with restrictions moving forward, we will always keep some of those going, because we know that that's something that women really like to do, and there's so many benefits for your mental health by being outside and exercising, and but still having that opportunity to talk and to be heard and to listen to others. And you know, we during the most strict times of the pandemic, we moved those groups onto Zoom, and we still have a Zoom group going, and we will keep a Zoom group going for people who, for whatever reason, can't travel to access our services or don't feel well enough to actually come to face-to-face services. So there is always that other option for them. And our antenatal classes are still on Zoom at the moment, and they're based on wellness in pregnancy and on a piece of work which has come from King's College London on which is very CBT based. And we will keep those via Zoom at the moment. The information we have is that pregnant women are still classed as a high risk group. And so it is the appropriate place for those to happen. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, whether they may become face-to-face groups or whether pregnant women prefer and find it easier to access that via Zoom. But we certainly know from the feedback that we've had that they've been a great source of support to women going through very, very difficult experiences in pregnancy at the moment. And then we also have an art psychotherapy and counselling service, which is available to anyone who is one of our clients. And so they can either have person-centred counselling, or they can have art psychotherapy, and they're assessed at the beginning of that journey to help us understand and for them to make a decision on which is most appropriate for them. And again, those can take place either take place face-to-face in Hartcliffe in the family centre where we're based, or they take place via Zoom. So if before the pandemic, if you said to me it would be possible to do art psychotherapy via Zoom, I would have had a good old cackle about that and thought, how on earth could we possibly deliver that? But when times happen where you've got to do something, you find out where you're doing it, and we have, and it's worked really well. So we will carry on offering that as well to women who prefer to access it that way. And I think, you know, it's been an absolutely horrific time the last 14 months for so many people. So many people have lost family members. So many people have been poorly, have watched other people be poorly. So many people in key worker positions have had to work so incredibly hard and under such difficult circumstances. There are little bits of positivity we can take away, and one of those for us is the way that we've changed our services. We're going to be able to carry that learning through to the future, which is going to help us provide better services for women in the years to come, because we had to do that really intense piece of learning very, very quickly in March 2020. And there's no point in abandoning that learning. If things change, we need to take that forward, because there's so much more demand for our services than there's ever been before, but also because the complexity that people are bringing with them alongside their mental health is higher than it's ever been before. So it's really important we get this right. You only get one chance in these early years to get things right, and every opportunity you have where you speak with a woman is a golden opportunity to make a difference in that woman's life and the life of her child. So it's really important to get it right for everyone who works with pregnant women and women in the postnatal period.
I'm a yoga teacher, but I just sent my son to go and eat a load of biscuits to keep him quiet and out of the way while I did my very important work.
I'm a yoga teacher, but I feel like I'm having a very vain month, and I've just had my eyebrows done. And I'm finally surprised.
As I said before, they look amazing. Yeah, totally on fleek.
Mine's going to be really lame now, I'm sure, but I'm a CEO, and part of being a CEO is that you are multitasking every minute of every day. But at home, when I'm just Maria and I'm mum, I am the most hopeless multitasker there is, and I cannot do more than one thing at one time. I've got to start something and finish it before I can move on to the next. So I don't carry that skill into my normal life. And for being a mum, I'm a mum, but my guilty secret, but actually I think it's a really important part of being a mum, is I have a period in the day which is timetabled in my timetable, which is just for me on my own every day, where I'm not doing work and I'm not doing mothering, and I'm just being me. And that's what refuels me and gives me the energy to keep going. So it's a really important part of my day.
What do you do in that time? I'm dying to know. I'm a yoga teacher, but the first thing that jumped to my mind was not, oh, I'll do a yoga practice, but I'm going to sit in front of the TV and eat crisps.
So, yeah, things like that. I actually spend time in a room on my own. And when I'm there, I will either read something which is completely non-work related, or I'll watch a TV show. And I do tend to watch sort of like medicalized TV shows. I have no idea why, but I really enjoy those. So at the moment, and I'm late to the party on this, but I'm watching Grey's Anatomy.
I was going to start that one. I'm late to the party too. You recommend it?
I'm enjoying it. I am enjoying it. Yes.
Thank you so much, Maria, for joining us today and sharing so honestly. I think your story is one that's really going to stay with people.
I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity as well. I mean, I don't very often get the opportunity to talk about my son, William, who died. So it's really nice to have that opportunity. I've met so many amazing people because of him, who my paths would never have crossed with them had it not been for him. When you have a baby who dies, something that people in that community often say is you become part of the club you never wanted to become part of. But actually the strength that bereaved parents draw from each other is really incredible, and the parents that I met all those years ago are still some of my very closest friends today, and that's such a huge gift, and I'm so lucky to have it. But I really appreciate the opportunity of coming to talk to you about him today. That's been really wonderful for me. Thank you.
Oh, it's been so lovely to hear everything you've had to share. And I'm so glad William's still with you every day and inspiring your work. You are a tremendous birth advocate. You're doing such wonderful, powerful stuff that's making such a huge difference. So I'm really honoured that you had the time to come and speak with us. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you so much, Maria, for sharing all of this information. And I really hope that anyone who has been thinking about getting in touch with Mothers for Mothers now does so, hearing what wonderful services you provide and how you know it's going to be a safe place now and you're not going to be judged, and the people that you're speaking to have lived experience of what you're going through. Thank you so very, very much.